its way underneath. Garrity walked close to the railing, and looking over, he could see, for just a moment, a distorted image of his own face. They passed a sign which read Limestone 7 miles, and then under, a rippling banner which said, "Limestone is proud to welcome the Long Walkers." Garrity figured they had to be less than a mile from breaking the record. Then the word came back, and this time the word was about a boy named Curly, number 7. Curly had a Charlie horse and had already picked up his first warning. Garrity put on some speed and came even with McVries and Olson. "Where is he?" Olson jerked his thumb at a skinny, gangling boy in blue jeans. Curly had been trying to cultivate sideburns. The sideburns had failed. His lean and earnest face was now set in lines of terrific concentration, and he was staring at his right leg. He was favoring it. He was losing ground, and his face showed it.
"Warning! Warning 7!
Curly began to force himself faster. He was panting a little. As much from fear as from his exertions, Garrity thought. Garrity lost all track of time. He forgot everything but Curly. He watched him struggle, realizing in a numb sort of way that this might be his struggle an hour from now, or a day from now. It was the most fascinating thing he had ever seen. Curly fell back slowly, and several warnings were issued to others before the group realized they were adjusting to his speed in their fascination, which meant Curly was very close to the edge.
"Warning! Warning 7! Third warning 7!
"I've got a Charlie horse!"
Curly shouted hoarsely.
"It ain't no fair if you've got a Charlie horse!"
He was almost beside Garrity now. Garrity could see Curly's Adam's apple going up and down. Curly was massaging his leg frantically, and Garrity could smell panic coming off Curly in waves, and it was like the smell of a ripe, freshly cut lemon. Garrity began to pull ahead of him, and the next moment, Curly exclaimed,
"Thank God! She's loosening!"
No one said anything. Garrity felt a grudging disappointment. It was mean and unsporting, he supposed, but he wanted to be sure someone got a ticket before he did. Who wants to bow out first? Garrity's watch said 11:05 now. He supposed that meant they had beaten the record, figuring 2 hours times 4 miles an hour. They would be in Limestone soon. He saw Olson flex first one knee, then the other again. Curious, he tried it himself. His knee joints popped audibly, and he was surprised to find how much stiffness had settled into them. Still, his feet didn't hurt. That was something. They passed a milk truck parked at the head of a small dirt feeder road. The milkman was sitting on the hood. He waved good-naturedly.
"Go to it, boys!"
Garrity felt suddenly angry, felt like yelling.
"Why don't you just get up off your fat ass and go to it with us?"
But the milkman was past 18. In fact, he looked well past 30. He was old.
"Okay, everybody, take 5, Olson cracked suddenly and got some laughs.
The milk truck was out of sight. There were more roads now, more policemen and people honking and waving. Someone threw confetti. Garrity began to feel important. He was, after all, Maine's own. Suddenly, Curly screamed. Garrity looked back over his shoulder. Curly was doubled over, holding his leg and screaming. Somehow, incredibly, he was still walking, but very slowly. Much too slowly. Everything went slowly then, as if to match the way Curly was walking. The soldiers on the back of the slow-moving half-track raised their guns. The crowd gasped, as if they hadn't known this was the way it was, and the walkers gasped, as if they hadn't known, and Garrity gasped with them, but of course he had known. Of course they had all known. It was very simple. Curly was going to get his ticket. The safeties clicked off. Boys scattered from around Curly like quail. He was suddenly alone on the sun-washed road.
"It isn't fair!" he screamed. "It just isn't fair!"
The walking boys entered a leafy glade of shadow, some of them looking back, some of them looking straight ahead, afraid to see. Garrity was looking. He had to look. The scatter of waving spectators had fallen silent, as if someone had simply clicked them all off.
"It isn't..."
Four carbines fired. They were very loud. The noise traveled away like bowling balls, struck the hills, and rolled back. Curly's angular, pimply head disappeared in a hammer smash of blood and brains and flying skull fragments. The rest of him fell forward on the white line like a sack of mail. 99 now, Garrity thought sickly. 99 bottles of beer on the wall, and if one of those bottles should happen to fall... Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus. Stebbins stepped over the body. His foot slid a little in some of the blood, and his next step with that foot left a bloody track, like a photograph in an official detective magazine. Stebbins didn't look down at what was left of Curly. His face didn't change expression. "Stebbins, you bastard," Garrity thought. "You were supposed to get your ticket first, didn't you know?" Then Garrity looked away. He didn't want to be sick. He didn't want to vomit. A woman beside a Volkswagen bus put her face in her hands. She made odd noises in her throat, and Garrity found he could look right up her dress to her underpants, her blue underpants. Inexplicably, he found himself aroused again. A fat man with a bald head was staring at Curly and rubbing frantically at a wart beside his ear. He wet his large, thick lips and went on looking and rubbing the wart. He was still looking when Garrity passed him by. They walked on. Garrity found himself walking with Olson, Baker, and McVries again. They were almost protectively bunched up. All of them were looking straight ahead now, their faces carefully expressionless. The echoes of the carbines seemed to hang in the air still. Garrity kept thinking about the bloody footprint that Stebbins' tennis shoe had left. He wondered if it was still tracking red, almost turned his head to look, then told himself not to be a fool. But he couldn't help wondering. He wondered if it had hurt Curly. He wondered if Curly had felt the gas-tipped slugs hitting home, or if he had just been alive 1 second and dead the next. But of course it had hurt. It had hurt before, in the worst rupturing way, knowing there would be no more you, but the universe would roll on just the same, unharmed and unhampered. The word came back that they had made almost 9 miles before Curly bought his ticket. The major was said to be as pleased as Punch. Garrity wondered how anyone could know where the hell the major was. He looked back suddenly, wanting to know what was being done with Curly's body, but they had already rounded another curve. Curly was out of sight.
"What have you got in that pack sack?"
Baker asked McVries suddenly. He was making an effort to be strictly conversational, but his voice was high and reedy, near to cracking. "A fresh shirt," McVries said, "and some raw hamburger."
"Raw hamburger?" Olson made a sick face.
"Good fast energy in raw hamburger," McVries said.
"You're off your trolley. You'll puke all over the place."
McVries only smiled. Garrity kind of wished he had brought some raw hamburger himself. He didn't know about fast energy, but he liked raw hamburger. It beat chocolate bars and concentrates. Suddenly he thought of his cookies. But after Curly, he wasn't very hungry. After Curly, could he really have been thinking about eating raw hamburger? The word that one of the walkers had been ticketed out ran through the spectators, and for some reason they began to cheer even more loudly. Thin applause crackled like popcorn. Garrity wondered if it was embarrassing, being shot in front of people, and guessed by the time you got to that, you probably didn't give a tin whistle. Curly hadn't looked as if he gave a tin whistle, certainly. Having to relieve yourself, though, that would be bad. Garrity decided not to think about that. The hands on his watch now stood firmly straight up at noon. They crossed a rusty iron bridge spanning a high, dry gorge, and on the other side was a sign reading, "Entering Limestone City Limits. Welcome, Long Walkers." Some of the boys cheered, but Garrity saved his breath. The road widened, and the walkers spread across it comfortably, the groups loosening up a little. After all, Curly was 3 miles back now. Garrity took out his cookies and for a moment turned the foil package over in his hands. He thought homesickly of his mother, then stuffed the feeling inside. He would see Mom and Jan in Freeport. That was a promise. He ate a cookie and felt a little better. "You know something?" McFreeze said. Garrity shook his head. He took a swig from his canteen and waved at an elderly couple sitting beside the road with a small cardboard "Garrity" sign. "I have no idea what I'll want if I do win this," McVries said. "There's nothing that I really need. I mean, I don't have a sick old mother sitting home or a father on a kidney machine or anything. I don't even have a little brother dying gamely of leukemia." He laughed and unstrapped his canteen. "You've got a point there," Garrity agreed. "You mean I don't have a point there? The whole thing is pointless." "You don't really mean that," Garrity said confidently. "If you had to do it all over again..." Yeah, I'd still do it, but..." "Hey!" The boy ahead of them, Pearson, pointed. "Sidewalks!" They were finally coming into the town proper. Handsome houses set back from the road looked down at them from the vantage of ascending green lawns. The lawns were crowded with people, waving and cheering. It seemed to Garrity that almost all of them were sitting down, sitting on the ground, on lawn chairs like the old men back at the gas station, sitting on picnic tables, even sitting on swings and porch gliders. He felt a touch of jealous anger. "Go ahead and wave your asses off. I'll be damned if I'll wave back anymore. Hint 13, conserve energy whenever possible." But finally, he decided he was being foolish. People might decide he was getting snotty. He was, after all, Maine's own. He decided he would wave to all the people with Garrity signs, and to all the pretty girls. Side streets and cross streets moved steadily past. Sycamore Street and Clark Avenue, Exchange Street, and Juniper Lane. They passed a corner grocery with a Narragansett beer sign in the window and a 5 and dime plastered with pictures of the major. The sidewalks were lined with people, but thinly lined. On the whole, Garrity was disappointed. He knew the real crowds would come further down the line, but it was still something of a wet firecracker. And poor old Curly had missed even this. The major's jeep suddenly spurted out of a side street and began pacing the main group. The vanguard was still some distance ahead. A tremendous cheer went up. The major nodded and smiled and waved to the crowd. Then he made a neat left face and saluted the boys. Garrity felt a thrill go straight up his back. The major's sunglasses glinted in the early afternoon sunlight. The major raised the battery-powered loudhailer to his lips. "I'm proud of you boys. Proud!" From somewhere behind Garrity, a voice said softly, but clearly, "Diddly shit." Garrity turned his head, but there was no one back there but 4 or 5 boys watching the major intently. One of them realized he was saluting and dropped his hand sheepishly. And Stebbins... Stebbins did not even seem to be looking at the major. The jeep roared ahead. A moment later, the major was gone again. They reached downtown Limestone around 12:30. Garrity was disappointed. It was pretty much of a one-hydrant town. There was a business section and three used car lots and a McDonald's and a Burger King and a Pizza Hut and an industrial park, and that was Limestone.
"It isn't very big, is it?"
Baker said. Olson laughed.
"It's probably a nice place to live," Garrity said defensively.
"God spare me from nice places to live," McVree said,
but he was smiling.
"Well, what turns you on?"
Garrity said lamely. By 1 o'clock, Limestone was a memory. A small, swaggering boy in patched denim overalls walked along with them for almost a mile, then sat down and watched them go by. The country grew hillier. Garrity felt the first real sweat of the day coming out on him. His shirt was patched to his back. On his right, thunderheads were forming, but they were still far away. There was a light, circulating breeze, and that helped a little.
"What's the next big town, Garrity?" McVries asked.
"Caribou, I guess." He was wondering if Stebbins had eaten his last sandwich yet. Stebbins had gotten into his head like a snatch of pop music that goes around and around until you think you're going to go crazy with it. It was 1:30. The long walk had progressed through 18 miles.
"How far's that?"
Garrity wondered what the record was for miles walked with only one walker punched out. 18 miles seemed pretty good to him. 18 miles was a figure a man could be proud of. "I walked 18 miles. 18.
"I said," McVries began patiently, "maybe 30 miles from here?"
30, Pearson said. "Jesus!"
"It's a bigger town than Limestone," Garrity said. He was still feeling defensive, God knew why. Maybe because so many of these boys would die here. Maybe all of them. Probably all of them. Only 6 long walks in history had ended over the state line in New Hampshire, and only one had gotten into Massachusetts. And the expert said that was like Hank Aaron hitting 730 home runs, or whatever it was, a record that would never be equaled. Maybe he would die here, too. Maybe he would. But that was different. Native soil. He had an idea the major would like that.
"He died on his native soil."
He tipped his canteen up and found it was empty.
"Canteen," he called.
47 calling for a canteen."
One of the soldiers jumped off the half-track and brought over a fresh canteen. When he turned away, Garrity touched the carbine slung over the soldier's back. He did it furtively, but McVries saw him.
"Why'd you do that?"
Garrity grinned and felt confused.
"I don't know. Like knocking on wood, maybe?"
"You're a dear boy, Ray," McVries said,
and then put on some speed and caught up with Olson, leaving Garrity to walk alone, feeling more confused than ever. Number 93, Garrity didn't know his name, walked past him on Garrity's right. He was staring down at his feet, and his lips moved soundlessly as he counted his paces. He was weaving slightly.
"Hi," Garrity said.
93 cringed. There was a blankness in his eyes, the same blankness that had been in Curly's eyes while he was losing his fight with a Charlie horse.
"He's tired," Garrity thought. "He knows it and he's scared."
Garrity suddenly felt his stomach tip over and right itself slowly. Their shadows walked alongside them now. It was 2:15. 9 in the morning, cool, sitting on the grass in the shade, was a month back. And just before 2, the word came back again. Garrity was getting a first-hand lesson in the psychology of the grapevine. Someone found something out, and suddenly it was all over. Rumors were created by mouth-to-mouth respiration. "It looks like rain. Chances are it's going to rain. It's going to rain pretty soon. The guy with the radio says it's going to shit potatoes pretty quick." But it was funny how often the grapevine was right. And when the word came back that someone was slowing up, that someone was in trouble, the grapevine was always right. This time the word was that number 9, Ewing, had developed blisters and had been warned twice. Lots of boys had been warned, but that was normal. The word was that things looked bad for Ewing. He passed the word to Baker, and Baker looked surprised.
"The black fella?"
Baker said.
"So black he looks sorta blue?"
Garrity said he didn't know if Ewing was black or white.
"Yeah, he's black," Pearson said. He pointed to Ewing.
Garrity could see tiny jewels of perspiration gleaming in Ewing's natural. With something like horror, Garrity observed that Ewing was wearing sneakers. Hint 3. Do not, repeat, do not wear sneakers. Nothing will give you blisters faster than sneakers on a long walk.
"He rode up with us," Baker said.
"He's from Texas."
Baker picked up his pace until he was walking with Ewing. He talked with Ewing for quite a while, then he dropped back slowly to avoid getting warned himself.
His face was bleak.
"He started to blister up 2 miles out. They started to break back in limestone. He's walking in pus from broken blisters."
They all listened silently. Garrity thought of Stebbins again. Stebbins was wearing tennis shoes. Maybe Stebbins was fighting blisters right now.
"Warning! Warning, 9! This is your third warning, 9!
The soldiers were watching Ewing carefully now. So were the walkers. Ewing was in the spotlight. The back of his t-shirt, startlingly white against his black skin, was sweat-stained gray straight down the middle. Garrity could see the big muscles in his back ripple as he walked. Muscles enough to last for days, and Baker said he was walking in pus. Blisters and charley horses. Garrity shivered. Sudden death. All those muscles, all the training, couldn't stop blisters and charley horses. What in the name of God had Ewing been thinking about when he put on those PF flyers? Barkovich joined them. Barkovich was looking at Ewing, too.
"Blisters!"
He made it sound like Ewing's mother was a whore.
"What the hell can you expect from a dumb nigger, now I ask you?"
"Move away," Baker said evenly, "or I'll poke you."
"It's against the rules," Barkovich said with a smirk. "Keep it in mind, cracker."
But he moved away. It was as if he took a small poison cloud with him. 2 o'clock became 2:30. Their shadows got longer. They walked up a long hill, and at the crest, Garrity could see low mountains, hazy and blue in the distance. The encroaching thunderheads to the west were darker now, and the breeze had stiffened, making his flesh goosebump as the sweat dried on him. A group of men clustered around a Ford pickup truck with the camper on the back cheered them crazily. The men were all very drunk. They all waved back at the men, even Ewing. They were the first spectators they had seen since the swaggering little boy in the patched overalls. Garrity broke open a concentrate tube without reading the label and ate it. It tasted slightly porky. He thought about McVree's hamburger. He thought about a great big chocolate cake with a cherry on the top. He thought about flapjacks. For some crazy reason, he wanted a cold flapjack full of apple jelly. The cold lunch his mother always made when he and his father went hunting in November. Ewing bought a hole about 10 minutes later. He was clustered in with a group of boys when he fell below speed for the last time. Maybe he thought the boys would protect him. The soldiers did their job well. The soldiers were experts. They pushed the other boys aside. They dragged Ewing over to the shoulder. Ewing tried to fight, but not much. One of the soldiers pinned Ewing's arms behind him while the other put his carbine up to Ewing's head and shot him. One leg kicked convulsively.
"He bleeds the same color as anyone else," McVree said suddenly.
It was very loud in the stillness after the single shot. His Adam's apple bobbed and something clicked in his throat. Two of them gone now. The odds infinitesimally adjusted in favor of those remaining. There was some subdued talk, and Garrity wondered again what they did with the bodies.
"You wonder too goddamn much," he shouted at himself suddenly, and realized he was tired.
Part 2. Going Down the Road. Chapter 3. It was 3 o'clock when the first drops of rain fell on the road, big and dark and round. The sky overhead was tattered and black, wild and fascinating. Thunder clapped hands somewhere above the clouds. A blue fork of lightning went to earth somewhere up ahead. Garrity had donned his coat shortly after Ewing had gotten his ticket, and now he zipped it and turned up his collar. Harkness, the potential author, had carefully stowed his notebook in a baggie. Barkovich had put on a yellow vinyl rain hat. There was something incredible about what it did to his face, but you would have been hard put to say just what. He peered out from beneath it like a truculent lighthouse keeper. There was a stupendous crack of thunder.
"Here it comes!" Olson cried.
The rain came pouring down. For a few moments, it was so heavy that Garrity found himself totally isolated inside an undulating shower curtain. He was immediately soaked to the skin. His hair became a dripping pelt. He turned his face up into the rain, grinning. He wondered if the soldiers could see them. He wondered if a person might conceivably... While he was still wondering, the first vicious onslaught let up a little, and he could see again. He looked over his shoulder at Stebbins. Stebbins was walking hunched over, his hands hooked against his belly, and at first Garrity thought he had a cramp. For a moment Garrity was in the grip of a strong panicky feeling, nothing at all like he had felt when Curly and Ewing bought it. He didn't want Stebbins to fold up early anymore. Then he saw Stebbins was only protecting the last half of his jelly sandwich, and he faced forward again, feeling relieved. He decided Stebbins must have a pretty stupid mother not to wrap his goddamn sandwiches in foil just in case of rain. Thunder cracked stridently, artillery practice in the sky. Garrity felt exhilarated, and some of his tiredness seemed to wash away with the sweat from his body. The rain came again, hard and pelting, and finally let off into a steady drizzle. Overhead, the clouds began to tatter. Pearson was now walking beside him. He hitched up his pants. He was wearing jeans that were too big for him, and he hitched up his pants often. He wore horn-rimmed glasses with lenses like the bottoms of Coke bottles, and now he whipped them off and began to clean them on the tail of his shirt. He goggled in that myopic, defenseless way that people with very poor eyesight have when their glasses are off.
"Enjoy your shower, Garrity?"
Garrity nodded. Up ahead, McVries was urinating. He was walking backward while he did it, spraying the shoulder considerately away from the others. Garrity looked up at the soldiers. They were wet too, of course, but if they were uncomfortable, they didn't show it. Their faces were perfectly wooden. "I wonder what it feels like," he thought, "just to shoot someone down. I wonder if it makes them feel powerful." He remembered the girl with the sign, kissing her, feeling her ass, feeling her smooth underpants under her pedal pushers. That had made him feel powerful.
"That guy back there sure doesn't say much, does he?" Baker said suddenly.
He jerked a thumb at Stebbins. Stebbins' purple pants were almost black now that they were soaked through.
"No. No, he doesn't."
McVries pulled a warning for slowing down too much to zip up his fly. They pulled even with him, and Baker repeated what he had said about Stebbins.
"He's a loner, so what?" McVries said, and shrugged.
"I think..."
"Hey,"
Olson broke in. It was the first thing he had said in some time, and he sounded queer.
"My legs feel funny."
Garrity looked at Olson closely and saw the seedling panic in his eyes already. The look of bravado was gone. "How funny?" he asked.
like the muscles are all turning baggy.
Relax, McVries said. It happened to me a couple of hours ago. It passes off.
Relief showed in Olson's eyes.
Does it?
Yeah, sure it does.
Olson didn't say anything, but his lips moved. Garrity thought for a moment he was praying, but then he realized he was just counting his paces.
Two shots rang out suddenly. There was a cry, then a third shot. They looked and saw a boy in a blue sweater and dirty white clam diggers lying face down in a puddle of water. One of his shoes had come off. Garrity saw he had been wearing white athletic socks. Hint 12 recommended them. Garrity stepped over him, not looking too closely for holes. The word came back that this boy had died of slowing down. Not blisters or a Charlie horse, he had just slowed down once too often and got a ticket. Garrity didn't know his name or number. He thought the word would come back on that, but it never did. Maybe nobody knew. Maybe he had been a loner like Stebbins. Now they were 25 miles into the long walk. The scenery blended into a continuous mural of woods and fields, broken by an occasional house or a crossroads, where waving, cheering people stood in spite of the dying drizzle. One old lady stood frozenly beneath a black umbrella, neither waving, nor speaking, nor smiling. She watched them go by with gimlet eyes. There was not a sign of life or movement about her, except for the wind-twitched hem of her black dress. On the middle finger of her right hand, she wore a large ring with a purple stone. There was a tarnished cameo at her throat. They crossed a railroad track that had been abandoned long ago. The rails were rusty, and witchgrass was growing in the cinders between the ties. Somebody stumbled and fell, and was warned, and got up, and went on walking with a bleeding knee. It was only 19 miles to Caribou, but dark would come before that. No rest for the wicked, Garrity thought, and that struck him funny. He laughed. McVries looked at him closely. Getting tired?
No, Garrity said. I've been tired for quite a while now.
He looked at McVries with something like animosity.
You mean you're not?
McVries said, Just go on dancing with me like this forever, Garrity, and I'll never tire. We'll scrape our shoe on the stars and hang upside down from the moon.
He blew Garrity a kiss and walked away. Garrity looked after him. He didn't know what to make of McVries. By 4:15, the sky had cleared, and there was a rainbow in the west, where the sun was sitting below gold-edged clouds. Slanting rays of the late afternoon sunlight colored the newly turned fields they were passing, making the furrows sharp and black where they contoured around the long, sloping hills. The sound of the half-track was quiet, almost soothing. Garrity let his head drop forward and semi-dozed as he walked. Somewhere up ahead was Freeport. Not tonight or tomorrow, though. Lots of steps. Long way to go. He found himself still with too many questions and not enough answers. The whole walk seemed nothing but one looming question mark. He told himself that a thing like this must have some deep meaning. Surely it was so. A thing like this must provide an answer to every question. It was just a matter of keeping your foot on the throttle. Now, if he could only...
He put his foot down in a puddle of water and started, fully awake again. Pearson looked at him quizzically and pushed his glasses up on his nose.
You know that guy that fell down and cut himself when we were crossing the tracks?
Yeah, it was Zuck, wasn't it?
Yeah. I just heard he's still bleeding.
How far to Caribou, maniac? Somebody asked him.
Garrity looked around. It was Barkovich. He had tucked his rain hat into his back pocket where it flapped obscenely.
How the hell should I know?
You live here, don't you?
It's about 17 miles, McVries told him.
Now go peddle your papers, little man.
Barkovich put on his insulted look and moved away.
He's some hot ticket, Garrity said.
Don't let him get under your skin, McVries replied. Just concentrate on walking him into the ground.
Okay, coach.
McVries patted Garrity on the shoulder.
You're going to win this one for the Gipper, my boy.
It seems like we've been walking forever, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Garrity licked his lips, wanting to express himself and not knowing just how.
Did you ever hear that bit about a drowning man's life passing before his eyes?
I think I read it once, or heard someone say it in a movie.
Have you ever thought that might happen to us? On the walk?
McVries pretended to shudder.
Christ, I hope not.
Garrity was silent for a moment, and then said,
Do you think... Never mind. To hell with it.
No, go on. Do I think what?
Do you think we could live the rest of our lives on this road? That's what I meant. The part we would have had if we hadn't... You know.
McVries fumbled in his pocket and came up with a package of mellow cigarettes.
Smoke?
I don't.
Neither do I, McVries said,
and then put a cigarette into his mouth. He found a book of matches with a tomato sauce recipe on it. He lit the cigarette, drew smoke in, and coughed it out.
Garrity thought of hint 10, save your wind. If you smoke ordinarily, try not to smoke on the long walk.
I thought I'd learn, McVries said defiantly.
It's crap, isn't it?
Garrity said sadly. McVries looked at him, surprised, and then threw the cigarette away.
Yeah, he said. I think it is.
The rainbow was gone by 4 o'clock. Davidson, 8, dropped back with him. He was a good-looking boy except for the rash of acne on his forehead.
That guy Zuck's really hurting, Davidson said.
He had had a pack sack the last time Garrity saw him, but he noticed that at some point Davidson had cast it away.
Still bleeding? McVries asked.
Like a stuck pig, Davidson shook his head. It's funny the way things turn out, isn't it? You fall down any other time, you get a little scrape. He needs stitches.
He pointed to the road.
Look at that.
Garrity looked and saw tiny dark spots on the drying hardtop.
Blood?
It ain't molasses, Davidson said grimly.
Is he scared?
Olson asked in a dry voice.
He says he doesn't give a damn, Davidson said. But I'm scared.
His eyes were wide and gray.
I'm scared for all of us.
They kept on walking. Baker pointed out another Garrity sign.
Hot shit, Garrity said without looking up.
He was following the trail of Zuck's blood, like Daniel Boone tracking a wounded Indian. It weaved slowly back and forth across the white line.
McVries?
Olson said. His voice had gotten softer in the last couple of hours. Garrity had decided he liked Olson in spite of Olson's brass balls outer face. He didn't like to see Olson getting scared, but there could be no doubt that he was.
What? McVries said.
It isn't going away. That baggy feeling I told you about? It isn't going away.
McVries didn't say anything. The scar on his face looked very white in the light of the setting sun.
It feels like my legs could just collapse, like a bad foundation. That won't happen, will it? Will it?
Olson's voice had gotten a little shrill. McVries didn't say anything.
Could I have a cigarette?
Olson asked. His voice was low again.
Yeah, you can keep the pack.
Olson lit one of the mellows with practiced ease, cupping the match, and thumbed his nose at one of the soldiers watching him from the half-track.
They've been giving me the old hairy eyeball for the last hour or so. They've got a sixth sense about it.
He raised his voice again.
You like it, don't you, fellas? You like it, right? That goddamn right, is it?
Several of the walkers looked around at him and then looked away quickly. Garrity wanted to look away, too. There was hysteria in Olson's voice. The soldiers looked at Olson impassively. Garrity wondered if the word would go back on Olson pretty quick, and couldn't repress a shudder. By 4:30, they had covered 30 miles. The sun was half gone, and it had turned blood red on the horizon. The thunderheads had moved east, and overhead the sky was a darkening blue. Garrity thought about his hypothetical drowning man again. Not so hypothetical at that. The coming night was like water that would soon cover them. A feeling of panic rose in his gullet. He was suddenly and terribly sure that he was looking at the last daylight in his life. He wanted it to stretch out. He wanted it to last. He wanted the dusk to go on for hours.
Warning! Warning 100! Your third warning 100!
Zuck looked around. There was a dazed, uncomprehending look in his eyes. His right pants leg was caked with dried blood, and then suddenly he began to sprint. He weaved through the walkers like a broken field runner carrying a football. He ran with that same dazed expression on his face. The half-track picked up speed. Zuck heard it coming and ran faster. It was a queer, shambling, limping run. The wound on his knee broke open again, and as he burst into the open ahead of the main pack, Garrity could see the drops of fresh blood splashing and flying from the cuff of his pants. Zuck ran up the next rise, and for a moment he was starkly silhouetted against the red sky, a galvanic black shape, frozen for a moment in mid-stride, like a scarecrow in full flight. Then he was gone, and the half-track followed. The two soldiers that had dropped off it trudged along with the boys, their faces empty. Nobody said a word. They only listened. There was no sound for a long time. An incredibly, unbelievably long time. Only a bird, and a few early May crickets, and somewhere behind them, the drone of a plane. Then there was a single sharp report, a pause, then a second.
"Making sure," someone said sickly.
When they got up over the rise, they saw the half-track sitting on the shoulder, half a mile away. Blue smoke was coming from its dual exhaust pipes. Of Zuck, there was no sign. No sign at all.
"Where's the Major?"
someone screamed. The voice was on the raw edge of panic. It belonged to a bullet-headed boy named Gribble, number 48.
"I want to see the Major, goddammit! Where is he?"
The soldiers walking along the verge of the road did not answer. No one answered.
"Is he making another speech?"
Gribble stormed.
"Is that what he's doing? Well, he's a murderer. That's what he is. A murderer. I'll tell him. You think I won't? I'll tell him to his face. I'll tell him right to his face."
In his excitement, he had fallen below the pace, almost stopping, and the soldiers became interested for the first time.
"Warning! Warning, 48!
Gribble faltered to a stop and then his legs picked up speed. He looked down at his feet as he walked. Soon they were up to where the half-track waited. It began to crawl along beside them again. At about 4:45, Garrity had supper. A tube of processed tuna fish, a few snappy crackers with cheese spread, and a lot of water. He had to force himself to stop there. You could get a canteen any time, but there would be no fresh concentrates until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and he might want a midnight snack. Hell, he might need a midnight snack.
"It may be a matter of life and death," Baker said, "but it sure isn't hurting your appetite any."
"Can't afford to let it," Garrity answered.
I don't like the idea of fainting about 2 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Now there was a genuinely unpleasant thought. You wouldn't know anything, probably. Wouldn't feel anything. You'd just wake up in eternity.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
Baker said softly. Garrity looked at him. In the fading daylight, Baker's face was soft and young and beautiful.
Yeah, I've been thinking about a whole hell of a lot of things.
Such as? Him, for one, Garrity said, and jerked his head toward Stebbins, who was still walking along at the same pace he had been walking at when they started out. His pants were drying on him. His face was shadowy. He was still saving his last half-sandwich.
What about him?
I wonder why he's here, why he doesn't say anything, and whether he'll live or die.
Garrity, we're all going to die.
But hopefully not tonight, Garrity said. He kept his voice light, but a shudder suddenly racked him. He didn't know if Baker saw it or not. His kidneys contracted. He turned around, unzipped his fly, and began walking backward.
What do you think about the prize? Baker asked.
I don't see much sense thinking about it, Garrity said, and began to urinate. He finished, zipped his fly, and turned around again, mildly pleased that he had accomplished the operation without drawing a warning.
I think about it, Baker said dreamily. Not so much the prize itself as the money. All that money.
Rich men don't enter the kingdom of heaven, Garrity said. He watched his feet, the only things that were keeping him from finding out if there really was a kingdom of heaven or not.
Hallelujah,
Olson said. There'll be refreshments after the meeting.
You a religious fella? Baker asked Garrity.
No, not particularly, but I'm no money freak.
You might be, if you grew up on potato soup and collards, Baker said. Side meat only when your daddy could afford the ammunition.
Might make a difference, Garrity agreed, and then paused, wondering whether to say anything else. But it's never really the important thing. He saw Baker looking at him, uncomprehendingly, and a little scornfully.
You can't take it with you, that's your next line, McVree said.
Garrity glanced at him. McVree's was wearing that irritating, slanted smile again.
It's true, isn't it? He said. We don't bring anything into the world, and we sure as shit don't take anything out.
Yes, but the period in between those two events is more pleasant in comfort, don't you think? McVree said.
Oh, comfort. Shit, Garrity said. If one of those goons riding that overgrown Tonka toy over there shot you, no doctor in the world could revive you with a transfusion of 20s or 50s.
I ain't dead, Baker said softly.
Yeah, but you could be.
Suddenly it was very important to Garrity that he put this across. What if you won? What if you spent the next 6 weeks planning what you were going to do with the cash? Never mind the prize, just the cash. And what if the first time you went out to buy something, you got flattened by a taxicab?
Harkness had come over and was now walking beside Olson. Not me, babe, he said. First thing I'd do is buy a whole fleet of checkers. If I win this, I may never walk again.
You don't understand, Garrity said, more exasperated than ever. Potato soup or sirloin tips, a mansion or a hovel, once you're dead, that's it. They put you on a cooling board like Zuck or Ewing, and that's it. You're better to take it a day at a time, is all I'm saying. If people just took it a day at a time, they'd be a lot happier.
Oh, such a golden flood of bullshit, McVree said.
Is that so? Garrity cried. How much planning are you doing?
Well, right now I've sort of adjusted my horizons, that's true.
You bet it is, Garrity said grimly. The only difference is, we're involved in dying right now.
Total silence followed that. Harkness took off his glasses and began to polish them.
Olson looked a shade paler. Garrity wished he hadn't said it. He had gone too far. Then someone in back said quite clearly,
"Hear, hear!"
Garrity looked around, sure it was Stebbins, even though he had never heard Stebbins' voice. But Stebbins gave no sign. He was looking down at the road. "I guess I got carried away," Garrity muttered, even though he wasn't the one who had gotten carried away. That had been Zuck. "Anyone want a cookie?" He handed the cookies around, and it got to be 5 o'clock. The sun seemed to hang suspended halfway over the horizon. The earth might have stopped turning. The 3 or 4 eager beavers who were still ahead of the pack had dropped back until they were less than 50 yards ahead of the main group. It seemed to Garrity that the road had become a sly combination of upgrades with no corresponding downs. He was thinking that if that were true, they'd all end up breathing through oxygen faceplates before long, when his foot came down on a discarded belt of food concentrates. Surprised, he looked up. It had been Olson's. His hands were twitching at his waist. There was a look of frowning surprise on his face.
"I dropped it," he said. "I wanted something to eat, and I dropped it."
He laughed, as if to show what a silly thing that had been. The laugh stopped abruptly.
"I'm hungry," he said.
No one answered. By that time, everyone had gone by, and there was no chance to pick it up. Garrity looked back and saw Olson's food belt lying across the broken white passing line.
"I'm hungry," Olson repeated patiently.
"The major likes to see someone who's raring to rip."
Wasn't that what Olson had said when he came back from getting his number? Olson didn't look quite so raring to rip anymore. Garrity looked at the pockets of his own belt. He had 3 tubes of concentrate left, plus the snappy crackers and the cheese. The cheese was pretty cruddy, though. "Here," he said, and gave Olson the cheese. Olson didn't say anything, but he ate the cheese.
"Musketeer," McVries said, with that same slanted grin.
By 5:30, the air was smoky with twilight. A few early lightning bugs flitted aimlessly through the air. A ground fog had curdled milkily in the ditches and lower gullies of the fields. Up ahead, someone asked what happened if it got so foggy you walked off the road by mistake. Barkovich's unmistakable voice came back quickly and nastily.
"What do you think, Dumbo?"
Foregone, Garrity thought. 8.5 hours on the road, and only 4 gone. There was a small pinched feeling in his stomach. "I'll never outlast all of them," he thought. "Not all of them. But on the other hand, why not? Someone had to." Talk had faded with the daylight. The silence that set in was oppressive. The encroaching dark, the ground mist collecting into small curdled pools. For the first time it seemed perfectly real and totally unnatural, and he wanted either Jan or his mother, some woman, and he wondered what in the hell he was doing and how he ever could have gotten involved. He could not even kid himself that everything had not been up front, because it had been, and he hadn't even done it alone. There were currently 95 other fools in this parade. The mucus ball was in his throat again, making it hard to swallow. He realized that someone up ahead was sobbing softly. He had not heard the sound begin, and no one had called his attention to it. It was as if it had been there all along. 10 miles to Caribou now, and at least there would be lights. The thought cheered Garrity a little. It was okay after all, wasn't it? He was alive, and there was no sense thinking ahead to a time when he might not be. As McVries had said, it was all a matter of adjusting your horizons. At 6:15, the word came back on a boy named Travin, one of the early leaders who was now falling slowly back through the main group. Travin had diarrhea. Garrity heard it and couldn't believe it was true, but when he saw Travin, he knew that it was.
The boy was walking and holding his pants up at the same time. Every time he squatted, he picked up a warning. And Garrity wondered sickly why Travin didn't just let it roll down his legs. Better to be dirty than dead. Travin was bent over, walking like Stebbins with his sandwich, and every time he shuddered, Garrity knew that another stomach cramp was ripping through him. Garrity felt disgusted. There was no fascination in this, no mystery. It was a boy with a bellyache, that was all, and it was impossible to feel anything but disgust and a kind of animal terror. His own stomach rolled queasily. The soldiers were watching Travin very carefully, watching and waiting. Finally, Travin half squatted, half fell, and the soldiers shot him with his pants down. Travin rolled over and grimaced at the sky, ugly and pitiful. Someone retched noisily and was warned. It sounded to Garrity as if he was spewing his belly up whole. "He'll go next," Harkness said in a businesslike way.
"Shut up!" Garrity choked thickly. "Can't you just shut up?"
No one replied. Harkness looked ashamed and began to polish his glasses again. The boy who vomited was not shot. They passed a group of cheering teenagers sitting on a blanket and drinking Cokes. They recognized Garrity and gave him a standing ovation. It made him feel uncomfortable. One of the girls had very large breasts. Her boyfriend was watching them jiggle as she jumped up and down. Garrity decided that he was turning into a sex maniac.
"Look at them jahoobies," Pearson said. "Dear, dear me."
Garrity wondered if she was a virgin, like he was. They passed by a still, almost perfectly circular pond, faintly misted over. It looked like a gently clouded mirror, and in the mysterious tangle of water plants growing around the edge, a bullfrog croaked hoarsely. Garrity thought the pond was one of the most beautiful things he had ever seen.
"This is one hell of a big state," Barkovich said someplace up ahead.
"That guy gives me a royal pain in the ass," McVries said solemnly. "Right now my one goal in life is to outlast him."
Olson was saying a Hail Mary. Garrity looked at him, alarmed.
"How many warnings has he got?" Pearson asked.
"None that I know of," Baker said.
"Yeah, but he don't look so good."
"At this point, none of us do," McVries said.
Another silence fell. Garrity was aware for the first time that his feet hurt. Not just his legs, which had been troubling him for some time, but his feet. He noticed that he had been unconsciously walking on the outside of the soles, but every now and then he put a foot down flat and winced. He zipped his jacket all the way up and turned the collar against his neck. The air was still damp and raw.
"Hey, over there!" McVries said cheerfully.
Garrity and the others looked to the left. They were passing a graveyard situated atop a small grassy knoll. A fieldstone wall surrounded it, and now the mist was creeping slowly around the leaning gravestones. An angel with a broken wing stared at them with empty eyes. A nuthatch perched atop a rust-flaking flag holder left over from some patriotic holiday and looked them over perkily.
"Our first boneyard," McVries said. "It's on your side. Ray, you lose all your points. Remember that game?"
"You talk too goddamn much," Olson said suddenly.
"What's wrong with graveyards, Henry, old buddy? A fine and private place, as the poet said. A nice watertight casket."
"Just shut up."
"Oh, pickles," McVries said. His scar flashed very white in the dying daylight. "You don't really mind the thought of dying, do you, Olson? Like the poet also said, it ain't the dying, it's laying in the grave so long." "Is that what's bugging you, booby?" McVries began to trumpet.
"Well, cheer up, Charlie. There's a brighter day come—"
"Leave him alone," Baker said quietly.
"Why should I? He's busy convincing himself he can crap out any time he feels like it, that if he just lays down and dies, it won't be as bad as everyone makes out.
Well, I'm not going to let him get away with it.
If he doesn't die, you will, Garrity said.
Yeah, I'm remembering, McVree said, and gave Garrity his tight slap.